Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So, winter retreat. Hopefully, everybody's starting to settle and get peaceful. It's good to ask ourselves, is the mind starting to settle? Is it getting peaceful? And is there some bright mental states occurring, or is there some sort of obstruction coming up? So, it's good to check in, ask oneself. And winter retreat's a good time to be fostering and cultivating just the roots of our practice, the things we came here for. It's easy, especially those of us who've been here longer, easy to get off on tangents or sidetracks. So winter retreat is an ideal time to just come back to the roots of the practice, come back to the source. Just picking up on a couple of threads from Longpa's Dhamma talk last night. And particularly one that what the mind needs keeps changing, and it's not always the same. We can't always just plug away at buddho or just plug away at focusing on the breath at the tip of the nose and hope that that's going to make the mind peaceful every single time. So we have to have a whole range of tools that we're using in order to get the mind to settle. Might be various contemplations, or also might be things like just skillful means that we come up with, creative ways to settle the mind. Like during the meditation, just listening to the frogs, the crickets, just thinking the sounds of nature are peaceful, or just feeling the perfect temperature this evening and the smells of kind of an early springtime, the smells of springtime, the frogs in the valley, just helping the mind to go inward and settle. And a lot of us come to the practice for very different reasons. Some people come through suffering, some kind of suffering. Come to the practice to try to gain insight into that suffering or alleviate that suffering. Some people come to the practice because it's something interesting and inspiring and fascinating. So there's various different reasons why we're all here. And we might experience different things when we listen to a Dhamma talk. Sometimes we might enjoy listening to talks, or we might listen to a talk on the internet. This talk is recorded, put up on the internet later. We're listening on the internet. We might listen to a Dhamma talk with the idea that we like listening to some Dhamma talks because they're interesting, fascinating, inspiring. Some people give very funny Dhamma talks, tell stories, tell interesting stories. And so we might listen to a Dhamma talk and it might make us feel happy. Might make us feel happy temporarily. But I think what it's really important to come back to, and something I like to come back to during winter retreat, and something that I personally came to the monastery for, was just a cultivation of a weariness with samsara. In using this time during the winter retreat, just to find various ways to refocus back on that weariness with samsara. And this goes hand in hand with sense restraint and sila samadhipanya and our whole cultivation of virtue. But all the talks we listen to, all the Dhamma books we read, and all the practices we cultivate should be leading towards a sense of weariness with samsara. And all of us who are monks here, who are newly ordained or becoming more senior, then we ought to be becoming more weary with samsara, as opposed to more intoxicated with samsara. What does that mean, intoxication? That means intoxicated with sights, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile sensations, ideas. We can get intoxicated with all those things, interested in all those things. All those things are interesting. So that's what we call intoxication with samsara. Wanting to focus on those things, wanting to absorb into those things that involve the senses. And so the Buddha talked about sense restraint, like, for example, sense restraint of the eye, not giving rise to focusing on the marks, the signs and features, or sounds, smells, and so on, the same. So how do we cultivate a sense of weariness with these things? We can't just become weary of samsara just by an act of will. If we're really interested in the world, then obviously we're not weary with samsara. But it comes through wisdom and contemplation. And we need a base of virtuous action just to have enough breathing room just to even be able to see things clearly. So the Buddha talked about the 10 paths or the 10 courses of wholesome action and the 10 paths of unwholesome action. So I think that's a good starting point. Three of those bases are bodily action, four involve verbal action, and three involve mental action. So that's the 10 bases of both unwholesome and wholesome action. So the first base of unwholesome bodily action would be the taking of life, the first precept. And wholesome would be the refraining from taking of life, intentionally taking life. Or like this phrase of the Buddha, like with rod and weapon laid aside, one is a protector of life, one delights in protecting life. And before I start to go into this, I can just say that the 10 bases of wholesome action, they can be practiced in almost every moment. That's something that's amazing about them. Even while you're just sitting still meditating, doing sitting or walking meditation, the bases of wholesome action can be practiced all the time. So that it makes it really interesting as a contemplation and as a practice, as a cultivation of a base for the holy life. So like the first base of wholesome action, being a protector of life. Second base of wholesome bodily action is not taking what is not given. The third base of wholesome bodily action is not engaging in sexual misconduct. The four bases of wholesome verbal action are refraining from telling lies, refraining from harsh speech, refraining from divisive speech, or we could call it defamatory speech, refraining from idle chatter. And then the three bases of mental wholesome action are thoughts of non-harming, refraining from thoughts of covetousness, and right view. So we take like the first one, being a protector of life. This was coming up in my mind, walking up and down the hill, as trying to walk up and down sometimes without using my flashlight. Just that's a practice that Lungpur Liam would praise. Just try to make it like in the old days when they didn't have flashlights at Wat Pa Pong, and try to train yourself to walk up and down to your kuti in the dark. But then I found I'd be walking up, and especially this season right now after it's been raining, walking up and you're walking up the road and just walking in the dark, and then crunch, you step on a millipede. And this little guy, sorry about that, crushed you. So I start to use my flashlight so I don't crush the millipedes. Or you can just pick them up and toss them off the road so they don't get run over by one of the vehicles or crushed by somebody else. Just little things like that. You can just practice virtue in just little ways almost all the time. Salamanders. There's salamanders out right now. Don't want to step on one of those guys. Salamanders are really peaceful creatures. They just move really slow. You can just, if you see one in the road, you can just pick it up in your hand. It doesn't seem to mind. Just pick it up in your hand and set it off to the side. And when I first came here, I was pretty strict with being a vegetarian. I was kind of vegetarian on and off, but then after I ordained as a bhikkhu, I decided to be really strict with it for 1 or 2 years. Was pretty determined with it, but it was interesting because it was based on a view that I had that I was practicing this vegetarianism so strictly. I wasn't doing it for health reasons or anything, or even necessarily out of compassion for animals, but I was doing it because I had developed a view that actually eating meat, I was actually guilty of the kama of killing in a very indirect way, but perhaps still reaping the fruit of the kama of killing animals if I was eating meat. And I really was doing it based on that view that somehow by eating this, I am adding to the demand. I'm adding to the demand of the meat market, and so therefore, even if it's just 1 or 2 more animals might be killed for my sake because I'm adding to that demand. But I kind of had doubts about this view, so I checked in with Lungpor about it eventually, and he just right away said, no, that's not how it works. To get the kama of killing, you have to have a clear intention. Have to really either kill that animal yourself or get someone else to kill it. It has to be very direct. And the fact that the food is offered to us makes it even less direct. The fact that we're not going to the store and buying it, it's even more removed. So whether it's meat or vegetables, food that's offered is very, very pure. So this is taking what's given to us. The perfect example of that is the offering of alms food or the receiving of alms food. You could even say it's made pure through the act of giving. It's made pure through generosity. So whether it's meat or whether it's vegetables, if it's a gift, then it's pure. That's not to say not to be vegetarian or vegan. Those are good things to do, and it's wholesome if it's out of compassion for animals. But kind of wanted to highlight that if there's a view there, it's good to question those views and see, well, is that really how it works? That's a good feeling when we just take what's given. There's different levels of that too. Like in the monk's rules, there's various allowances to ask for things in certain circumstances. But somehow when things are given to us spontaneously, it just seems so much better than if it's asked for. It might still be good or fully allowable if something was asked for. But when a gift is spontaneous, then it seems really great, both for the donor and for the one receiving it. the third base of unwholesome bodily action is sexual misconduct, and then we have its opposite is refraining from sexual misconduct. That's a base for wholesome action. So, of course, everybody living in the monastery is celibate. But this is a good one. You can get weary with samsara. Just looking at the world, it seems to be the norm nowadays, from what I've heard, from what people have told me. Sexual misconduct or cheating on one's partner, having affairs, that just seems to be the norm. We try to couch it in terms that make it seem wholesome. I've heard this term polyamory. It sounds like a really nice word, polyamory. It just sounds very gentle and doesn't at all take into account the fact that our just complete lack of concern for other people based on, say, like sexual misconduct or cheating on one's partner. So it really is, there's no doubt it's a course of unwholesome action, that sexual misconduct. If we really reflect on it and see like the hurt that it causes other people, and the lack of empathy for others, the lack of concern for others, the only concern is for oneself. So to be really, really careful. Yeah, we're just cultivating principles. These are true principles. And there's the virtue connected with speech. So the obvious one, which is refraining from telling lies. And then that one's actually not so easy to keep for most people, for myself anyway. If you really look at it and really look at how much of our speech is completely honest. So like, we might tell little lies here and there, or skirt around the truth, or find clever ways to maybe not reveal things if we want to be seen good by our peers or by our teachers. It might seem better to lie in certain circumstances. It might seem like, well, that person won't like us if I told the truth, or my teacher will criticize me if I tell the truth. And so we might not out and out lie, but it just might be like, we might find devious little ways to skirt around the truth or not reveal things, not reveal how we are. So we have to be careful with that. Or if like somebody says like, how are you doing? And just without thinking, oh, good. But then we might not be doing so good. And it's not that we need to be like freeze every time someone asks us how we're doing. How am I actually doing? I need to give a completely honest answer. But, we can just find ways like if I'm not doing so good, I might say like, well, I'm okay. Or like if when somebody asked Ajahn Chah, they would ask him like, Lungpa, how are you doing? And he would say, Pa Ton Dai, which it means it's endurable. So I think that's a good answer. It's endurable. Whatever it is, it's endurable. If we're completely honest with ourselves too, that's pretty helpful for practice. All these external trainings go internal as well. So lying, like really, really coarse out and out lies, those are kind of easy to give up. But then it's that the sense of being deceptive, that's what we really want to relinquish. Cause in the end we're only deceiving ourselves. We're our own witness. Yeah, it takes a lot of mindfulness to see that. It takes a lot of just like a sati sampajanya, like mindfulness and clear comprehension, like a well-rounded well-rounded assessment, well-rounded knowing of oneself. Then there's harsh speech. In the monastery, we're all pretty gentle in our speech. Currently, anyway, everybody here right now. So we don't really have to tell anybody to stop yelling. Stop yelling, stop cursing, stop swearing. We don't have anybody like that here currently. You know, sometimes there might be expletives muttered, hit your hand with a hammer, or get stung by a bee or something, then that's understandable. In general, as renunciates, we should try to refrain from expletives and harsh speech, any type of harsh speech in general. But certainly, we don't want to be like bellowing loudly, giving someone a piece of our mind. It's just not helpful. And the next one maybe occurs a bit more. It's divisive speech or defamatory speech. This is in subtle or not so subtle ways trying to divide people from each other, maybe trying to talk trash about somebody else in order to get the other person to talk trash about them, or just you just don't like somebody or irritated by somebody, so there might be just remarks about them. We don't realize the effect it's having. We don't realize it might be the other person might believe us and not like that, not like the person we're talking about because of what we're saying. So you have to be really careful with that, the harm that divisive and defamatory speech can have on community. And one of the reasons Abhayagiri is so harmonious is people are putting effort into this type of virtue. Idle chatter is the next one. Refraining from idle chatter is a basis of virtue, and probably everyone would agree that this is the most difficult one to keep in terms of the speech virtues. And idle chatter, I've heard teachings where it says like it's like Pabanka Rinpoche in the book Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand. He talks about at length about idle chatter, and he says it's not really like that bad of kama. You could say it is bad kama, but it's not that extreme to engage in idle chatter. But it becomes a lot because we're doing it all the time. So it's like little drops here and there adding up. And that's one of the benefits of noble silence, is just having a good excuse to not engage in idle chatter. But it's so much of a habit, and it really depends on our intention too. Like somebody's having a rough time, you might need to just give them some time, give them some attention, tell them some jokes, get them out of themselves a little bit. That might be, if that intention is there, then perhaps that's wholesome. But in general, idle chatter, it's just endless. It just goes on and on and on. Like Master Xu Yun said, like, how much idle, empty chatter do you want to hear? Just how much will it be enough to finally fill the ears up? And it'll just never happen. They'll never be full. So we just have to ask ourselves, like, weariness with samsara, just like, how much idle chatter is enough? How much do we want to hear? And there's the mental courses for wholesome action. So it's like the Buddha said, it's unwholesome thoughts of harming, thoughts of ill will. So these are kind of like, they can just sneak in based on our mood, like if the mood is kind of low or bad, like those thoughts might start to sneak in. Somebody irritates us, annoys us, so thoughts of harming. It might not be like wanting to really inflict physical harm on them, but just wanting to get rid of them somehow, get away. Thoughts of aversion. And then just dwelling on those thoughts, just making much of them, making them bigger. And those are, of course, the unwholesome speech, unwholesome action comes from those thoughts. So ideally, if we have those thoughts, we don't act on them. We don't speak out based on them. We don't act on them. But then we still have an unwholesome karma in the mind. So we have like the vinaya, the restraint of body and speech. So we don't act on those things, and that's good. So, but it's the best then to be contemplating, cultivating wisdom, so that the unwholesome courses of thought don't come up so much. The next one is covetousness is an unwholesome karma of the mind. Covetousness. So I think this is a big one. Covetousness, just I want this, I want that. That's the root of taking that which is not given, covetousness. But then even if we don't break that precept of taking that which is not given, but the mind is still engaged in covetousness, that's a lot of suffering. It's a big burden. So this is where sense restraint comes in. So like, I can only talk about this because I've just had to work with it a lot. The mind that's covetousness, that is coveting things. So whether it's something beautiful, a beautiful person, a beautiful object, you know, wanting to even make something beautiful, just wanting to have Boricon, wanting to have monk's requisites that's really, really beautiful, really nice. That doesn't mean to say like we just let everything fall apart and kind of don't look after ourselves, don't look after our things, but just watching that mental state and being very careful, being very mindful, just to be able to catch it, be able to see it. Sounds, wanting good sounds, good smells, good tastes, wanting comfort, wanting good mental states, good ideas, interesting ideas. We can even covet things we already own. We can even covet our own possessions. We can give rise to a sense of delight in the things we already have, so, which seems innocent enough, but then if we look at like the Satipatthana Sutta, giving up covetousness and grief connected with the world, so the mind's just never going to be peaceful if it has that mental state of covetousness, abhija. We give up abhija domanasang, abhija domanasa. So covetousness and grief connected with the world. The 10th course of unwholesome action is wrong view. I think that comes back to like when I was talking about my view around vegetarianism. But seeing how much wrong view can inform our life and our actions, and just the importance of cultivating right view. Just really investigating and seeing like how do things really work, and studying the teachings a lot, studying the suttas a lot, discussing them, seeing how, and matching it with our own experience, seeing how do things really work here, what's actually happening. It's a really interesting sutta I read I think it's either in the Book of the Twos or Book of the Fives, Anguttara Nikaya, and the Buddha says, like, there's two particular types of monks. Say the first type has faith well established and has their virtue, paddhimokkha, restraint well established, sense restraint well established. They're highly learned, greatly learned in the Dhamma and Vinaya. And they're a skilled speaker on Dhamma. And people delight in their Dhamma. Then the second type of monk has faith well established. There's sila and restraint within the paddhimokkha well established. And sense restraint is established. They have great learning in the Dhamma and the Vinaya. And they speak the Dhamma in a way that's pleasing to people. They're skilled speakers on the Dhamma. But they have views which are skewed and not quite right. And the Buddha says that first person is of great benefit to people. And that second person, that second monk, does great harm to people. And then the sutta just ends. But I think that's interesting in that it highlights the... And he doesn't even say they have like out-and-out wrong view, but he says they have skewed views or they have distorted views. And that monk brings great harm to people. I think that's interesting in just highlighting the importance of just becoming established in right view and how wrong view is an unwholesome course of mental action. Or like you have the sutta of the dog duty ascetic, where he has a view that based on his dog duty asceticism, based on his acting like a dog, that he'll be reborn in some or another heavenly realm. And the Buddha is saying, well, if he holds to that wrong view, then on the breakup of the body after death, he'll be reborn in a lower realm. Even in a hell realm. But if he holds to the view of what's actually happening, that if he doesn't know what's going to happen after death, but then if he fulfills his dog duty ascetic practice perfectly, then he'll be reborn as a dog. So, but I think that sutta is interesting in the Buddha highlighting the detrimental effects of wrong view. So right view, we have like mundane right view and then super mundane right view. Mundane right view is all these acknowledgments of what's actually happening in reality. Like there is mother, there is father, there is action and the result of action. There are ascetics and Brahmins who have realized the Dhamma. There's this world, there's the other world. There's good and bad action. There's the results of good and bad action. So on. There's various orders of beings. And then the super mundane right views, the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. There is a cause of suffering. There's a cessation of suffering. There's the path leading to the cessation of suffering. It's kind of thinking like, what could it mean, like skewed views or distorted views? You might think like, oh wait, that's, is that right or not quite right? It's like just waiting, just seeing like, okay, that's interesting. Like that might not be quite right, or that might be distorted. So I have to be really, really careful here. But these 10 courses of wholesome action and then relinquishing 10 courses of unwholesome action, that just gives us a base or a foundation. Because there's just going to be too much confusion and turmoil in the mind to even be able to consider things clearly if we don't have that sila, that basis of sila. So once we're standing up on that foundation, and we start to contemplate things and really start to see clearly with the intention of liberation with the intention of just developing a weariness with samsara. And really try to give rise to that intention in any sense contact that we come into. I just think of like looking at the news, just how wearying that can be. Just thinking like every single time I check the news, it's just trivia, just endless trivia. So like the endless trivia of samsara, how much trivia do we want to take in? Or just thinking like just all things are impermanent. So if we get something that's good in life, we just have to realize that it's going to degeneration, it's going to ending. Or anybody we become friends with, or if we get married, even if we're married our whole life, then that ends, that changes. I was thinking like my grandma and grandpa, who had a perfect marriage, married for 66 years, and my grandpa passed away a few years ago. So even that perfect marriage had to come to an end. And just nothing is satisfactory. It might be even be an idea, well, maybe we can still be together after death, but it's not sure, it's not certain. Or your best friend is still like end up separating, going your separate ways. Even the state of ordination is impermanent. When you pass away, the body passes away, you're not ordained anymore. So you can't really say like I'm going to ordain forever. You can only say I'm going to ordain till death. What happens after death? You know, not sure. We fare on based on our actions, based on our karma. But we certainly don't take the robes with us, don't take anything with us. Weariness with samsara. We don't take anything with us except our actions, our good and bad karma. So thinking in this way, we start to detach ourselves from all these cycles. It just doesn't make sense anymore to crave beautiful sights, beautiful sounds, smells. It doesn't make sense to crave a good taste. It's just passing away so quickly. But we need sati sampajanya to see it really clearly, just in every moment. Like if we could take like eating as an example, if we just really absorb into the taste and absorb into the joy of eating the meal, then we don't see it. But if we step back while we're eating and eat in a very sober way, if we step back and investigate what's actually happening, the taste hitting the tongue, swallowing the food going into the stomach, really investigate what's actually happening, then we're not intoxicated by it. And then the food just gradually disappears from our bowl. The meal's finished. What happens when we're intoxicated with the meal? So what are we left with afterwards? Mind isn't settled, mind isn't peaceful. It's pretty difficult to go and walk meditation or sit meditation. It wants more, it wants something else. The mind is still hungry. Defilements are still hungry. They want more. They always want more. And you can try to give the defilements everything they want, but it's just like throwing things into a black hole. It just has no bottom. It'll never fill up. It'll never be enough. So we may as well just give up that intoxication. When you eat the meal in a cool and collected way, then what happens? What's that like? When there's mindfulness present during the meal, Afterwards, the mind is bright. You might feel a little bit of drowsiness based on the digestion, but it won't be that bad. Mind is ready to meditate, ready to give up all sorts of attachments. So just getting interested in giving up all sorts of attachments. Or even during the meditation, just when the mind starts to get interested in the breath, or the mind starts to get interested in Buddho, or it even gets interested in the knowing itself, then what's that like? It's getting interested in letting go of attachment, letting go of clinging. And then juxtaposition that with the mind that's the mind in the meditation, which is hoping for something off in the future or chewing over something in the past. That's really the mind. The mind is stuck in samsara, hoping for something off in the future, hoping for the next travel arrangement, the next move, mulling it over, getting interested in that. So if that's happening during the meditation, then the mind isn't present with the body. The mind isn't in the state of satipatthana. It's not at its base of mindfulness. So bringing the mind back to satipatthana, back to the body. I was reading a Lungpo Ban talk, and he's talking about if you want to go tudong, and if you're proliferating about going tudong, then just go tudong in the body. Just sit in meditation and just go tudong in the body. Just wander into the head hair, wander into body hair, wander into nails, wander into teeth, wander into skin, wander all throughout the body. And then when you get to an interesting place, like the bones, then stop and rest there for a while. Take a look around, see what's there. Rest in bones for a while. And just feel them, what are they like? You can camp out there for a while before you move on to something else. Liver, heart, kidneys, intestines, undigested food, and so on. So you can actually wander for a really long time in the body and not get tired of it. Really interesting. A lot of interesting sights. He talks about charnel ground practice in the same way. So one of the 13 ascetic practices that's allowable for Buddhist monks is charnel ground, going and living in a charnel ground and watching as the bodies burn, and then contemplating I am of that same fate. But nowadays, we don't have them in America, but even in Thailand, they're kind of hard to find now, real charnel grounds. It says the same, like the charnel ground, the body is the charnel ground. So just seeing how things are just decomposing all the time. Just bringing that mind back to the body all the time. Just the skin is always decomposing. It's always developing sores. It's always developing smells, which are repulsive. If we don't rub it down with soap every day, it's hard to be around. Sometimes it's not so hard to be around if it's our own body because we get used to it, but if it's the bodies of others that haven't been rubbed down with soap every day, then it can be pretty difficult. Our clothes get dirty. Smells from the body seep out. Smells from this corpse seep out into the clothes. Just like a charnel ground, just like a funeral sheet put over a corpse, the juices seep out into that sheet. It's happening every single day with us. seeping out into our clothing. If we don't wash it, then even if we remember to shower every day, if we don't wash our clothes, then it still smells awful. Just like a corpse sheet. Everybody in the world shares these characteristics, but here in the monastery, we bring it to light, we contemplate it. So this is like clean living. You'll look after our body and mind, look after our requisites. And this is also the middle way. It's like in Thai, like padi, like Lungpar Kinnery had this teaching of just padi, padi, just make everything padi. Just make everything good, good enough. But good enough according to the middle way. So like our clothes are clean, our body is clean, our mind is clean, our kuti is clean, and we're making everything clean and neat, and immaculate. And we're making everything beautiful. But it's not the kind of beauty that we're getting intoxicated with. It's the beauty that comes about from the state of not being intoxicated. We can have beautiful requisites or beautiful things that we make use of, but we can not be intoxicated by them. Things can be pleasing, and we can see that they're pleasing, not be intoxicated by it. That's why the Dhamma is beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, beautiful in the end, beautiful every step of the way. And it's just really calming when we stand on that base of virtue and just come back to sati, just come back to the body, just that contemplation of the body. Really cooling, really peaceful. That can be another skillful means. Like contemplation of death or contemplation of the body. Another skillful means to get the mind to settle down. Really, everybody has to come up with their own skillful means. It's different for everybody. But for sure, in the Thai forest tradition, then always pointing back to the body and always pointing back to the middle way, always back pointing back to padi, padi. You can even look at any of these great ajahns. Like, even if you like look at the picture of Ajahn Mun up there, or the picture of Ajahn Chah, you can even study those pictures. You can gain insight into the middle way. I just like to look at how they're wearing their robes, and that's the middle way right there. It's like there's various ways we can wear our robes, like. Like one way is like this sort of like what we call like the Bloy Wang way, like where you just like your robes are all loose and kind of scattered around and just like falling off. And then there's the like the ultra tight way, which is like this part of the robe here is like jacked up, like cutting off your circulation in your under your arm. And that's the ultra tight. Those are two extremes, the ultra loose and the ultra tight. But then if you look at Lungpar Mun's robe in that picture, it's neither too loose nor too tight. His robe is just padi, it's just perfect. It's just a little bit loose, it's comfortable, it's beautiful. The way his hands are in that picture, they're not rigid, but they're also not just off any which way. His hands are peaceful, and they're speaking of having standards, but they're not tight, and they're not rigid, but they're composed. They speak of having true principle. And the eyes, Ajahn Mun's eyes in that picture, they're firm, but they're also almost motherly. There's a sense of compassion. And also he's looking straight ahead. He's saying, are you willing to become weary with samsara like I have? willing to follow that example. We should all have a strong desire to transcend samsara. This is so important. And it doesn't mean making some sort of brief, heroic effort and then crashing, but just looking for steady practice. Again, like Lungpa was saying last night, how Lungpa Cha would say, yeah, if you're happy and inspired, practice. If you're sad, dejected, depressed, practice. Right practice, steady practice. Nobody has it good all the time. Nobody has it good all the time. So just looking for consistency and looking for integrity, developing true principle, developing even just common sense, just the middle way, just the beautiful. I'll leave that for this evening. Sama.